Welcome to the Peaceful Embodiment Podcast. I'm Jean Byrne.
And I'm Chandrika Gibson.
The Peaceful Embodiment Podcast is brought to you by Wisdom Yoga Institute.
We are researchers and practitioners in the field of yoga and well-being, and we're going to be having conversations on this podcast together and with interview guests around the intersection of mindfulness, yoga, and living well.
Thank you for joining us on the Peaceful Embodiment journey. So the title of this week's podcast is Who Gets to Be Peacefully Embodied?
I think that's a great question and a great topic, Jean. And I'd love to hear about the beginnings of Wisdom Yoga Institute's foundational training and where this idea of offering yoga and the practices of yoga to underserved populations comes in, because, yeah, you're right, not everybody gets to be peacefully embodied.
So I suppose for me, the origins of Wisdom Yoga Institute is the trainings that we offer in events that grew out of Yoga Space for me and Surya Health for Chandrika. And when we'd been in India for 6 months, we signed a lease on a commercial premises and decided to come back to Perth and open a yoga school. Now, this is the first time I'd owned a yoga school. It was maybe 14 years ago. Now it's 2020. And before, I'd just been teaching in gyms, and it was amazing because it was large classes. Lots of people were able to participate, obviously university students, so there's a whole lot of privilege there. However, classes were very, very cheap. Now, when we opened our school in Perth, obviously we needed an income. We had a small family. We had a lot of rent to pay and bills. It started to become very clear to me who could and could not attend yoga. So we always began with, you know, sliding scales and community classes. And that's here to this day. Since COVID, I've been teaching a free class every week, and Yoga Space has always had community classes, which are free for the community. So with Wisdom Yoga Institute and our foundational trainings, and also with a lot of our postgraduate yoga therapy trainings, it became really crucial for us once people reached a certain point in their training, either for the yoga therapy as qualified yoga teachers already, or in the foundational as already 200-hour registered or able to be registered as 200-hour teachers. We started overseeing this massive program, which is just hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of yoga. I think we're up to about $750,000 worth of free charity yoga in the community. And we started this off quite naively. We just knew that our classes weren't, we were in a business district, and our classes weren't representative of our society. And they are more so now, which is really interesting. I think also yoga wasn't as popular back then. And so we started offering classes for free in a lot of settings. So, for example, juvenile detention centres, prisons, pre-release centres, mother-baby yoga for women who are incarcerated, seniors' homes, Spine and Limb Foundation, Headspace. The list goes on. Just lots of marginalised and vulnerable groups in our society who, if they were at all interested in the benefits of mindfulness practice or yoga, really were not in a position, either due to financial constraints, due to the fact that they were experiencing domestic violence, perhaps simply the colour of their skin, because if we look at the incarceration rates in Australia, there's a telling story there, or perhaps because they were no longer able-bodied, that these people just did not have a place to practice, or there was barriers. And so for the last 14 years, and we don't always talk about it a lot, we've been talking about it a bit more in the last couple of years, that was always happening. And it's because not everybody gets to be peacefully embodied. You know, some people are the struggle to survive, to exist due to mental health concerns or due to poverty or due to not being able-bodied is just, you know, it's very difficult for most of us to realize and to see that the fact that we can even get on our mat. The other day I saw on Instagram, I try not to go onto Instagram, someone saying, you know, if you can only meditate for 5 minutes, then meditate for an hour. And I thought, how freaking entitled and privileged, particularly in the middle of all of the debates that we have going on throughout the world in relation to race and Black Lives Matter. Just how obscene to think that people have time on their hands to meditate.
Oh, I know. I mean, yeah, so starting from the beginning where you started, that program of not-for-profit service in your yoga trainings, that was part of what drew me to want to work with you initially. Mm-hmm. So around the same time that you were starting Yoga Space, I was qualifying as a yoga teacher. I think we know this because our sons are similar ages.
Yes,
so that was kind of the beginning for both of us with those two babies. And I started immediately to teach underserved populations in the form of working for cancer charities and teaching yoga for those not-for-profit organizations. So that was something that I think both of us have kind of embedded in us, that yoga should extend to as many people as want it. Whoever wants to kind of self-select for these practices, we want to try to
should have the capacity.
That. And if we have the privilege, which we do, to provide that free of charge or in subsidized rates or in a way where the user doesn't pay but a third party pays for them, then that's what both of us feel really passionate about, I think. So it's amazing the work that you've done under Yoga Space, and more recently as we kind of pulled our forces together into Wisdom Yoga Institute. It's really a remarkable service to the community and to yoga teachers.
Yes.
Who really, it's so important that they know how to not just teach yoga to different populations, but also to be present as a human being with people who are not like them.
And as time has gone on and we've gotten clearer on what we are doing, because really at the beginning it was just, we opened a school and then all of a sudden I thought, oh my God, like I have to charge people because there's bills. We can't not charge. It was very distressing. We had a free class a week and all of that, but it was deeply worrisome that it was become that all of a sudden I was teaching in a really exclusive way. So it began as something that something small, and now has turned into something quite huge. There's going to be about 1,000 classes offered this year.
Wow.
It's a lot to handle. I'm really glad that it's happening, but we've begun to really refine and understand a little bit more about what we're doing and the need to be a little bit more trauma sensitive and to understand culturally and linguistically diverse groups. And it's growing and changing, and I appreciate people's input that helps lots of students actually, with different experiences, different backgrounds have really provided a lot of perspective. But I think also one of the main things that occurs for a lot of our trainees and perhaps yoga therapists when they go into these situations, and I know that you will speak to the social determinants of health, is the all of a sudden this absolute wake up to their privilege. All of a sudden they realize, oh, this person, through no fault of their own, is in this current situation, whether that is wheelchair bound, whether that is incarcerated, whether that is fleeing domestic violence. And I think what it really is a wake-up call to is their privilege, which for most of us, we run around our whole life with that being really quite unchecked. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even some of the language, and I know both of us are quite good at picking up, the language that is appropriate for different communities. But I did just notice that wheelchair bound, I have read recently that wheelchair users don't necessarily like that. That they prefer to be a wheelchair user. It's a tool for them that gives them mobility. So they're not actually stuck. They're less stuck thanks to the tool. I think that's the understanding anyway. I'm, extrapolating from different bits and pieces I've picked up. But
I think what's really important is that we're all still learning, and we learn together from each other, from the people that we work with and the people that we have the opportunity to share these practices with. And for a lot of our trainees, they go in as the teacher, but actually they come out as the student, because they've learnt so much from the people that they're with.
Yes, absolutely. I was reflecting on a teaching experience recently because I met up incidentally with two women who were in drug and alcohol rehab, and one of my early yoga teaching experiences was in a rehab centre. And I can reflect back critically and see that I was being a bit schoolmarmish, like trying to tell them how to do yoga, when actually what they were living through, what they were experiencing, their embodied feeling was something quite different. And what they didn't need was someone saying, do this, don't do that, more of this, move your hand this way, move your foot that way. What they needed was more of what we now understand as a trauma-sensitive approach to yoga, more choice, more bodily autonomy. You can do it or not do it. You can, you know, make a different option here. And I didn't really have those teaching skills at the time.
And I think that's the danger of being a newer teacher without, for all of us, is that we're all learning along the way. And now as people training yoga teachers, having had so many of these experiences, I think it's also getting really comfortable in your own skin. So that as a teacher, if someone in class is doing something totally different to what you're actually teaching, if that was 10 years ago, that would have made me very uncomfortable and therefore a little bit unhappy. Mm-hmm. But now I love it. When someone's doing something totally different to what I'm doing, I feel like it's a win. I'm like, yes, people are, they have that bodily autonomy.
You've empowered them to make free choice for themselves.
Yeah, rather than feel, I don't want people to feel constrained. And so when it comes to who gets to be peacefully embodied, I think it's really important for us to remember that peaceful embodiment, one, occurs in different bodies and so feels different in those bodies. And the accessibility of practices that we might associate with something like becoming peacefully embodied, whether that is prayer or meditation or asana, it is not neutral. Okay, this is not neutral ground. And I think this is one of the issues with yoga being co-opted into a wellness tradition, that actually yoga was meant to be countercultural. Yoga and standing up for racial injustice, becoming actively anti-racist, challenging and dismantling structures, becoming very aware of homophobia and sexism, and becoming a good ally is part of the revolution that's occurring within our practice. It should be part of that transformation. But what's happening is we have this weird interplay of yoga and wellness, and a very prescriptive idea of wellness. And even to be well or to be healthy, it's not really got a lot to do necessarily with your yoga or meditation practice.
No, but let me pass some of that apart, the health and wellness together. I've just been reading a funny little book, Kitty Flanagan's Rules for Life.
Yeah.
She's hilarious. I think she's very amusing. I don't always agree with everything she says. And one of the things that I did take a little bit of umbrage at was her saying, oh, wellness. Wellness is not a word. It's a made-up thing. Now, I've got a master's degree in wellness. So,
well, it better be real.
So I want to say what I think it is. And look, I am on board with that kind of skepticism about it, because it has become a marketing tool and it has been co-opted by people with immense privilege who are talking about it as if it's immense marketing budgets, immense reach, big platforms to use to sell products to support wellness. As soon as you get to that selling products to support wellness, there's some icky feeling in me that comes up that I just
What is wellness then?
Well,
How would you define it?
There's lots of definitions for it. I would think about it in terms of having the elements of your life that matter to you in balance, in harmony, working for you.
Oh, I love that.
But it's only the things that matter to
yes,
you.
Yes, yes, yes,
yes. So spirituality may not matter to someone, in which case they don't need to have a spiritual practice as part of their wellness program or practices.
Yeah.
But exercise might matter to them. Physicality might matter to them. Social engagement might matter to them. Relationships might matter to them. Careers might matter to them. So we can all kind of make a conceptual wellness wheel with all these dimensions in it. And we can make a kind of self-assessment. Well, where do I put my energy? Where do I put my resources, both the tangible ones and the intangible ones?
I love how you frame all of these things, because that's exactly what I've been doing lately in terms of my practices and life goals, is thinking about what is it that matters to me.
Yeah. And what do you want more of in your future? You know, you kind of, you're always investing. If you're doing any kind of practice, you're investing in an aspect of your life. And so you should kind of try to figure out, well, what aspects do I want more of in my life? And does this practice feed those parts of me to develop myself in such a way that I can express myself in these fields if that's what my interest is or my pursuits are? So there's all these elements to wellness, and it is actually a real discipline. It's not a made-up discipline. And in that master's program, we studied things like motivational interviewing, health and wellness coaching, so supporting tools to support people to make good choices in their lives. But that all is underpinned by a huge amount of privilege, because who gets to make choices is the same question as who gets to be peacefully embodied.
So on that note then, I have a question for you, because basically, and we've all experienced this in a variety of ways, I would imagine. For example, I experienced infertility for 7 years and was unable to conceive. And I had many people in the yoga community saying, well, what is it that's unconscious that you haven't quite processed?
Your Svadhisthana chakra must have been blocked, Jane.
Yes, something was clearly blocked. And so people say, oh, you're always so stressed. And, you know, it wasn't that, because I went and bought a commercial property and opened a yoga school and got myself very stressed and found myself pregnant. I think it was just chance and just biology. So the question then I have is where the intersection of privilege, of wellness, and of health, because this whole worried well and white woman wellness industry, it's massive. And it's one of the reasons that you and I are both committed to teaching in a way which is inclusive and trauma-informed and reaches out, is actively bringing yoga to places. Because, for example, I've tried to set up programs to encourage people to have continuity from not-for-profits to come to yoga space, and just hit a whole lot of roadblocks and couldn't afford to pay for bus fares and organize transport. So there's a whole lot of, I think what happens in yoga and meditation, in these practices that we've been immersed in, is this general notion of the meritocracy, a complete ignorance to privilege, and that we are healthy through our choices. I make good choices, so therefore I am healthy.
Yes.
Now, is that the determinants of health?
Yep, you're getting towards those social determinants of health. So yes, the difference between health and wellness is something that I think is really important. To me, it's really important because I live with chronic illness, and no matter what I do, I'm probably not going to be 100% perfectly physically healthy. And no one is. If you live in a human body, these bodies are vulnerable, they're fragile, things happen.
In my 40s, I can tell you, they don't operate the same way that they do in their 20s.
Yeah, so if you're cruising along in your 20s, and you think
on
that
Instagram teaching people about
on Instagram,
wellness,
teaching people about wellness and selling, you know, yoni eggs or something, because the, you know, whatever the product is, it's almost always based on pseudoscience. But you're really saying to people that there's a moral value to having health, having really good high level health, being as fit as an Olympian is the moral peak that you could achieve.
And if you're not healthy, that is your fault.
Mm-hmm. Or if you don't look healthy, because people think they can judge your health by the way you appear superficially, when actually they don't know.
And this is a very societal issue. And I have it, it's something my son brings up all the time, is why all of his friends are skinnier than he is. And I always have to say to him, that doesn't mean that they are healthy. Mm-hmm. You know, from what you're telling me, they're consuming significantly greater amounts of sugar on a daily basis, drinking sugar. That's not good for their long-term health. So health and wellness is not always something that you can see.
Yes. So John Travis, or Jack Travis as he's known, one of the professors that was one of my co-supervisors in my master's project, he has created a beautiful continuum of wellness where he puts, and you know, it's a little bit simplistic, but it's a good explanation to get started on, of a man in a running kind of outfit powering along a track, and on the same track but facing the other direction, an older lady in a wheelchair. Now, they seem to be moving towards opposite ends of this continuum. On a superficial level, if you were asked which person is more well,
yep,
you might think it's the man running. Of course, he's got a high level of wellness compared to the lady in the wheelchair. But actually, when you look at his continuum, he's got the man running facing towards premature death, and he's got the woman in the wheelchair facing towards high-level wellness. Because what he's trying to express in his little model, mm-hmm, his little continuum, is that it doesn't matter what your physical health status is. You can face in the direction of your greater well-being or wellness.
Always.
Always. Yeah. Right up to the moment that you take your last breath.
Yes.
You can be well, because wellness is not just about the physical aspect of your body and, yep, the health of your body, the health of your organs, the functioning of them. You can have your organs removed and still be, yep, very, very well. Well, not all of them. You need some, yep, of them to survive. But you can have many parts of you operated on. You can have many deformities and disfigurements and diseases and still
but
be
you
really,
do,
really well.
You don't, I suppose, and I've worked with a lot of people who are living with chronic pain, mm-hmm, and is to, there's a whole, when we suddenly find ourselves not at our peak health or there's a change in our health, there's this whole biographical interruption.
Yes.
So the healing isn't necessarily always something that, you know, a physiotherapist or a doctor can help us with, because the work, the journey towards wellness is deeply existential. It's beginning to figure out, well, who am I now? Because there has been a big change in my own self-definition. And so it's about going on an existential journey to understand ourselves here and now. And I suppose that is becoming, that is the journey to peaceful embodiment, is really, who am I here and now in this moment, in this body? And how can I kind of feel that harmony? The only issue is wellness, as much as it is a choice, it often is somewhat tied to health. Mm-hmm. And particularly at this, you know, this year in 2020 with COVID and the highlight on kind of racial injustice throughout our world, there's just so much more that determines our capacity to whether we can even think about our wellness. And so therefore, at a much more simpler level, our health. And I think it could be important for those of us, for people listening, and I know I love it when you talk about this, to maybe share with us some of the social determinants of health to help us remember that whether we are healthy or not, it is not about how much green juice you drink and raw food, and there's a lot more going on than that.
Yeah, there absolutely is a lot more going on than that. And we can start with financial well-being. If
yes,
you have not been employed or are not being paid a livable wage, then you don't have the choice to have a green smoothie, because the base ingredients for that, although they may not actually be expensive, they require a level of accessibility to a supermarket or an organic grocer or whatever you're going to use. They require the equipment, they require the time, they require the energy.
And if we look at the wage disparity for women, mm-hmm, and people of color, that's already finance. So financial well-being or your financial situation. So that can be a social determinant of health.
Absolutely. And then you don't get to choose to go to a yoga class if you don't have any disposable income. Maybe you can find something free online, but that assumes that you have internet access. That assumes you have an up-to-date device. And I think this came out in the media during the lockdowns that, you know, not every child has equal access to learning from home if you're trying to educate,
yes,
yourself at home. So along with economic disparities, employment conditions, and the kind of threat of unemployment that hangs over,
yes,
many people, if they don't really have a capacity to generate an income that makes them comfortable financially, that is an important determinant of the choices that they can make.
And also,
they have less choices.
And some, I think it can be very easy to forget that some people are living in situations where food is scarce.
Yeah. Yeah, food is scarce, and, you know, people might judge those who buy junk food. But if you look at it on balance, you get a lot more calories for your buck in a drive-thru than in a supermarket. That is a real societal problem. That is a collective issue that we should be talking about and we should be addressing.
That fresh
But it's
food,
always framed fresh, as an individual choice.
Yes.
That you must resist the lure of the $1 chocolate bars, or you must resist, you know, the slushy at the 7-Eleven that is about 1,000 calories for a dollar.
Yeah.
So the individual is told that they're the ones who are at fault if they become obese because they're consuming these things
and
all the
really
time or unwell because of it.
That again is privilege speaking, because when you are in a position of power, or when you have white skin, or when you are male, or when you are able-bodied, it's very difficult to understand that other people's health is determined by factors outside of their control. I mean, a really good example is, if we look at the social determinants of health, is neighborhood and physical environment. So where I'm living right now, which is actually affordable compared to a lot of places in this city, but I moved out of town because I wanted to, and I know you did the same, I wanted to live among the trees, deeply connected to the natural environment. So the capacity, the walkability, the parks, the playgrounds, the connection to nature, it's there, it's ever present.
But that is a design aspect that is a problem with new development. So I also moved to the fringes, but there is a problem up there. There's things like not really footpaths. So that means you have to really jump in your car. If it's not safe to walk or ride on the streets because there's no footpaths, and particularly if you have children, you don't usually want them to ride on the road. You want them to ride on a footpath. They've built these massive big roundabouts that a child on a bike can't cross on their own. So it means that people are restricted to the physical activity, the kind of incidental activity that you might like to do if you had the capacity to do it. You can't do it if the built environment doesn't support that. And so you end up getting in a car and driving somewhere, driving to a gym and paying a gym membership to get your exercise. And that then is about privilege, because you need to be able to afford those gym memberships to run a car and register it and keep your license and all of that. So there's no kind of free and available and accessible, easy way for people to exercise if the built environment doesn't support that.
And certainly for some people, exercising in public, whether you're a woman running at night, feels, only recently, for the first time ever last weekend, I took myself on a bushwalk alone out into the bush because I was conditioned that was unsafe, and potentially it is. But certainly if you don't have white skin and you're, out at night having a run, we can see that is behavior that people would actively choose not to engage in, encourage their family not to engage in, due to the risks that are present simply by one's color of their skin.
Wasn't one of the men who was shot in the US recently bird watching as well?
No, he wasn't shot, but he copped a whole lot of racial abuse simply because he was in an area that was a public access area. It was just pure discrimination. So we can see that the community and social context in which people live in, I'm looking forward to reading, is it Dr. Gail Parker's?
Yes,
what's
looks
her
beautiful.
Book called?
I haven't got the title in my mind.
Restorative Yoga for Race-Based Trauma and Stress. So there's a whole experience of trauma and stress and intergenerational trauma that has direct impacts on people's health and their well-being. Community engagement, the support systems that are there, all are very different for women, for people of colour, for people who aren't able to just walk outside their front door, people who need assistance from others. So I also think another element to think about, and while Australia is imperfect, we have issues, but there's other countries obviously where this is much more difficult, is our healthcare system.
There's major health inequities between different communities, but particularly between different countries as well. So you're right, Australia's system, and through this pandemic, has shown itself to work reasonably well, but there are people who slip through the gaps.
And there's also a lot of race-based discrimination still, wherein
there sure is.
not everyone is receiving the same quality of care.
Not everyone's receiving the same quality of care. And getting back to that kind of social exclusion and even the unconscious biases of health professionals, one of the things that came out in my PhD research was that nurses, this is not my work, but this is someone else's work, nurses typically will spend less time with someone who is disfigured because it makes them uncomfortable to look at someone whose face is not symmetrical, who has, you know, blemishes or pus or whatever showing up. Now, that's nurses who on base, on, you know, generalizing, are extremely compassionate, who are dedicated to their work, but unconsciously they don't give as much of their care and time to people that look confronting. And that's not, you know, isolated just to that situation, but that's one example of that.
And for me, this is related to peaceful embodiment, because if we are truly practicing and getting in touch with and being present with ourselves as we are in this moment, mind, body, and heart, that really hopefully should open the door for a lot of compassion and a lot of empathy and the capacity to begin to understand the prejudices that we are conditioned into through racist and sexist and homophobic institutions, that it's schools, universities, family structures, and that we can begin to, while we may not be able to control our unconscious prejudice, we can certainly work very strongly, not just on not behaving in discriminatory ways, but also becoming proactively non-discriminatory in a whole range of areas. So it's also important to know that if we want to be well and we want to be healthy, that in terms of the social determinants of our health, which is always going to be tied to our well-being, even though we can separate the two, wellness and health, is that if we don't have culturally appropriate care, and whether that's someone who, for example, there's a woman who comes to my yoga classes, she identifies as Muslim and she doesn't want to go to a male class. If we don't have people who look like us, who have the traditions that we have, who have the shared cultural understandings, we're always going to be feeling other to a system. We're always going to feel unwell in that system. And it's the same way that the educational system works, in that it's highly ethnocentric and it's exclusionary, and it doesn't actually rate certain types of intelligences.
No, that's right. And I think if you are moving through this world with a lot of privilege, you don't necessarily notice that. So thinking about school and health systems, I would feel as a middle-class white person very welcome in those environments. And I happen to have some of the skills that made school easy. But for people who don't have that, it's a whole different experience. So that then brings me to another area of this social determinants of health, the early childhood stuff. And I think that, you know, this is really important when we're thinking about our students who come to classes who are likely to have embodied trauma that they have lived through. They may have many adverse childhood events. And also, because we can see that there is, again, this real privileging, this real kind of hogging of the limelight and the space of really people who are not seeing what's going on for others who are less privileged. I'm thinking about an article that I read over the weekend. It was about Alicia Silverstone. Do you remember her? She was like a 90s it girl. She was Cher in Clueless.
Oh, yep.
And she, I think she probably home birthed. She raised her baby with attachment parenting. She did things like elimination timing, holding her baby over, you know, pot plants or toilets, and still co-sleeps and all of this. And she became like a wellness blogger. She left Hollywood and became a wellness blogger and writer and published cookbooks and things like that. And I can remember those kinds of mummy wars going on in early childhood, the issues about whether you vaccinate or don't vaccinate, issues about, you know, whether you feed your children meat or whether you feed them organic vegetables, whether you wear cloth nappies or disposable nappies, whether you breastfeed or bottle feed, all of these things. And the people who are able to choose wellness and choose the kind of more alternative or more holistic frameworks to make their decisions within, they have a level of privilege that other people don't necessarily have.
Yeah.
That's all to do with the social determinants of health. Yes, that individual child who is unvaccinated and long-term breastfed and fed beautiful, healthy food is probably going to have a really good health experience, but that completely denies the public health responsibility So people are not thinking of the collective.
Yes.
Wellness becomes this individual pursuit. Yep. And I'm all right, Jack. If I'm okay, then I don't care that other people don't have all this.
There's a lack of social conscience, I think, when it comes to discussions of wellness. And I think it's because for many people, they want to feel that their efforts have resulted in their wellness. And certainly in relation to the conversations that are occurring now about race or conversations that I've had in the past about gender, it's the issue is people do work very hard to be well and healthy, or they do have worked very hard to have gotten where they've gotten in life. But it's very difficult for people to accept that there's a lot going on and a lot working in their favor that wasn't created by them or caused by them. And in fact, that they can actually be part of the problem rather than actively working towards a solution. Mm-hmm. So if it's one of the important messages that we want to be aware of in the Peaceful Embodiment podcast, is that peaceful embodiment is indeed a privilege. There are ways that we can help as yoga teachers to offer yoga as either social activism through fundraising, through supporting people doing work who have secondary trauma, to also offering for those people who want to, who have barriers to access yoga on the ground. And I think for me as a teacher, it's always been part of an ethical orientation to ensure that yoga is not simply taught in a way that's just for the white and the well and the able-bodied. Smoothie power is a sign of privilege, and it's important to understand that collectively we have a responsibility to create a context where we can help improve people's health in general at that sort of baseline. And that's why we are both, I'm studying psychology as part of that, and Chandrika, you're doing your PhD to get more information to therefore change practice. And even at the most simple level, to understand that people's health and wellness is often out of their control.
Yes, and this is partly why my work has been so much focused on the cancer population, because it's never a positive, it's never a good thing to happen in someone's life, but it's one of those real things, and there is an element of luck, there's an element of randomness. Yes, of course, there are lifestyle things that will lower your risk, but time and time again, I've seen people who come to me and say, but I've done everything right. I've lived really well. I've had a very healthy diet, a clean diet, which is, you know, kind of a revolting values-based thing to put on food. Food's not clean or dirty, but people talk about it in that way, that they've really made choices very consciously because they were able to eat well, to exercise, to meditate, and they come and see me as a cancer wellness coach and say, what did I do to deserve this? Did I cause this? Is this some kind of subtle, you know, was it my lack of spirituality? Was it my relationship with the universe that went wrong? Did I not say my mantra correctly? How did I get unlucky and get this disease? And really, they feel so disarmed. And I think that it's really helpful to remind them, you didn't cause this. This is not your fault. This can happen to anyone. And equally, the reverse can happen. Everybody's got an anecdote of some relative who lived to be 99, smoking and drinking and carrying on without any care for their health and well-being. But there's nothing that makes us immune to our body breaking down. There's nothing that will stop those cells going awry. The example I often give is the toenail. If you've got an ingrown toenail, can you wellness that away? Is your yoga going to help? It's not actually, it's going to hurt. Can you meditate it away? Can you use the power of your consciousness? Can you pray it away? Nope, you cannot. You need an intervention that is pretty mechanical, and you probably need a chemical intervention as well to stop that nail growing back. And then you need some time to heal, and then you can pursue the things that matter to you. So sometimes a biographical disruption, a health crisis, it does open up a space where people can then reassess, well, what were these assumptions I was making about health? Did I really think I was, you know, underwriting my own guarantee that I was going to live to be 99 without anything going wrong? it's just not realistic. So that peaceful embodiment really shows itself. And you know, that's where this began for me, was writing a course about refriending your body for people who've been through the trauma of cancer diagnosis and treatment and the side effects that arise from that and the kind of ongoing reinvention that has to happen because of that biographical disruption. You have now a space to rewrite your story, to figure out what matters, and to decide how you want to pursue what's left of your days and your time in this body. But you need to get okay with the changed body, and that is a process.
And I hope for many of us and many of us listening that it doesn't take that intense experience of biographical interruption to begin to understand that that health and that wellness is a privilege to even have the time to consider, and that health is something that's largely determined and something that you are largely born into, not something that you get to choose. And even at that simplest level, we hope that that can inspire you to look at your world a little bit differently and look at people who you see as other to you, different groups of people or people with different backgrounds or who look different to you, to begin to understand that we are not born into this world equal. Ultimately, as humans, we are equal. Yet, certainly when it comes to the social determinants of our health, which will inevitably affect our wellness and well-being, the inequity, the disparity is huge, and it's not enough to simply be positive and love everyone. There is work to be done, whether you love research like us, so research and study might be your avenue to then go on to clinically change guidelines and to help in that way. Perhaps you are going to help on the ground. Perhaps you're going to offer the services you have. Perhaps you're going to become actively anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-homophobic in your conversations in life and in your work. So there's always work for all of us to do. It is okay to also rest if you have the privilege to rest, but also to just remember we are born into our health.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you said it all. Good. Right. Let's leave it there, I reckon.
Well, thanks for listening. We always love your feedback, and see you later.
See ya.
Bye.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Peaceful Embodiment podcast today. If anything that has been discussed in this episode has raised concerns for you, or equally has inspired you and sparked ideas that you would like to get in touch with us about, you can reach out to us through our various social media platforms.
We would love you to subscribe to this channel, leave a review, and feel free to share this podcast episode with your friends and family. Be sure to find us on Facebook and Instagram at Wisdom Yoga Institute.